Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. This is for Thursday, January 5th, 2011. This is podcast number 76. As regular listeners know, I have skipped some podcasts. Kai is not with me today. She's in Ohio, and I am in Missouri. We've had a death in the family, so I've had to skip a few podcasts. I may try to get her on the phone to set up a podcast for the next day or two. I'm not sure exactly how that will work, but we'll see what the future brings. So this is the first of our podcasts for the new year, and it would certainly be easier if Kai were with me. I've actually tried to record a podcast maybe three or four, five times, something like that, in the last couple days, and wasn't able to due to the family loss and everything, and just the general upset and everything that's going on. I couldn't keep my mind clear enough to focus my thoughts and complete a podcast. So I'll attempt it again, and if this sounds coherent or even remotely coherent, I'll go ahead and put it out for Thursday. And as part of the disclaimer, I am in the motorhome, and you will probably hear a lot of background noises. There is a very busy highway close by. There are railroad tracks nearby. There is a very active auto body shop directly behind me. And so the acoustics are not good, and there's going to be a lot of background noise. And with me, as always, is Nikki the dog and Baggy the cat, and who knows what they're liable to pull. I did remember to take Nikki's collar off so that her dog tags, verification of dog tacks, that's what the dog tags really are. I've taken off her tax tags so that when she shakes her head, it doesn't sound like jingle bells. So this being the first podcast of the new year, I'm a little late on some of the more up-to-date things. Like, for instance, there was a Iowa caucus for the Republicans, and that came and went. And even though, oddly enough, even though Ron Paul stood to pretty easily win the Iowa caucus, somehow all the secret counting and everything produced a mainstream Republican win. I'm so shocked. Now, I don't say that in any way to mock the people who worked hard to get Ron Paul a victory in Iowa or have worked in the Ron Paul campaign in general. I have a great amount of sympathy for you and all the work that you're doing, and the fact that, in my opinion, you're wasting your time. I would, in many ways, love to see Ron Paul win. But on the other hand, for reasons that I've already made over and over to this microphone, I know that it's not going to happen. And if it did happen, if Ron Paul was given the Republican nomination, it would create a situation where one of two things would take place. Either they would just kill him, which I find highly likely. Growing up in the 1960s, I remember when things get rough, I remember how the state handles these situations. And I mentioned that on an earlier podcast, and then I heard two other podcasts where the podcasters had heard my podcast, and they were, of course, them, being not old like me, they weren't for sure exactly what I was referring to. So let me just lay out for you what happened in the 1960s. The 1960s started out with the American president partially plotting the assassination of the leader of another country. Now, that was John F. Kennedy planning the assassination of Fidel Castro. He was not able to pull that off, or chose not to, or for whatever reason, Castro lived. Kennedy made some disparaging remarks about the financial system and made indications that he was maybe not going to be the kind of a puppet that they wanted him to be. And then mysteriously a lone gunman assassinated John F. Kennedy. Now, there was also a situation where His brother had sort of made it almost a hobby of giving the mafia a hard time, and was also no friend of the FBI, the head of the FBI at the time, who was J. Edgar Hoover. And J. Edgar Hoover had spent his lifetime ignoring the mafia and actually openly saying in public that there was no mafia until J. Edgar Hoover was forced to admit that there actually was a mafia because, you know, anyway, I'm not going to go into the whole story of the guy who, the turncoat and ratted them all out and everything, but anyway, how can you not believe that there's a mafia, especially if you've ever been to any major East Coast city? But beside the point, J. Edgar Hoover somehow was able to make that argument with a straight face. And so Bobby Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, who was a strong opponent of and hated by J. Edgar Hoover, I might add, also was not on friendly terms with the president that took the place of his brother when his brother was assassinated. And there's a famous, just as a little conspiracy theory on the side, there's a famous picture floating around in just hours after John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Lyndon Johnson went almost in a straight line to Air Force One and got on board and evidently hid in the toilet. And after quite some time, they were able to get him out of the toilet. And they had a ceremony on Air Force One. Now, the ceremony was to officially swear him in as President of the United States. And they drug John F. Kennedy's wife in there and had her standing there in the little dress that she had been wearing when her husband's brains got splattered all over her. And they drug her straight from the hospital, stuffed her on the airplane, and had the ceremony real quick to swear in Lyndon Johnson as president. And there's this famous picture, and you can see it if you float around a little bit. Maybe I'll find a link to it and put that on the page that this podcast appears. But there's this moment when this picture is snapped, where LBJ, that's Lyndon Baines Johnson. Like Wolf Bane. Anyway, where Johnson looks over at one of the Secret Service guys and there's a wink exchanged, and it's sort of a high five moment. Now, without getting into a lot of the details, it is interesting that when the motorcade left the airport, that same airport, with John F. Kennedy on board the motorcade, the Secret Service made an instant last-minute change on how the Secret Service guys were supposed to ride on the limousine. And had they been riding on the limousine like they were supposed to, their bodies would have been in direct line of fire behind the president's head where he was supposedly shot from. Now, what that means is, every other time, they had a guy standing in that position. The one time that the president got shot in the back of the head, they didn't have a guy standing there. And that change was made at the airport that same day, right when they arrived and the motorcade took off. And then here we have LBJ and this Secret Service guy exchanging winks. There's a whole lot more than that. I mean, I'm not going to make this into the conspiracy theory shot in the head podcast, but there's a ton of stuff on the Kennedy conspiracy, and you, even if you don't believe the vast majority of it, there's just too many things to look the other way on if you look at it at all. So we had that where Kennedy was assassinated because, for whatever reason, without getting into a conspiracy thing on that. So Kennedy is shot. LBJ takes over. LBJ has a mutual enemy with the head of the FBI, the lifetime head of the FBI, the man practically that created the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. And their mutual enemy is Bobby Kennedy. And what happens to Bobby Kennedy? Well, we're told a crazed lone gunman killed him. Except there's all kinds of problems with that, too. For instance, Sirhan Sirhan, the crazed gunman, evidently ran up and just started randomly shooting at point-blank range at Kennedy. And the bullets are flying all over the place, and people are getting hit, and some of the bullets are going in the ceiling and in the walls and everything. And it turns out there's a wrong number of bullets. And in addition to that, there's two people who are seen by numerous witnesses running away and laughing. And when asked, you know, what's going on, they literally said, "We just shot Bobby Kennedy." And yet, it's Sirhan Sirhan. It's the crazed one lone gunman with the catcher in the right in his back pocket and mad scribblings in his diary. How odd. I wonder who else was assassinated by a single lone gunman with mad scribblings in their diary. Anyway, and so this continued in the 60s. We have Martin Luther King was assassinated by a man that, by all accounts, was almost too stupid to tie his own shoes. And yet he masterminded this assassination and got himself completely out of the country before they could, you know, get a hold of him and everything. And there's all kinds of problems with that assassination. And what was it? Well, one more. Now, the death of Malcolm X can be classified completely differently. And I haven't followed all the conspiracy theories on Malcolm X's death, but we'll just throw that in as an extra. Now that's just in the U.S. There were a number of foreign assassinations during the same time frame that you could easily link back to this. But these are just the big notable ones in the U.S. in the 1960s. And all of these have all these odd, suspicious problems with them. And then I'm not even going to go into the 70s because then we... Well, anyway. Okay, so yes, that's how the United States government, people within the United States government, were affected by assassinations during the 1960s. Now, the recent generations, you know, we haven't seen a lot of that. But then again, I almost forgot one. 1968, I believe, or 72. Now, well, maybe that was 72 when Democratic hopeful, what was his name? He was kind of a racist Southern Democrat from Alabama, if I recall. I should have looked up his name. Anyway, he's the one that coined the phrase in reference to the two parties. He's the one that coined the phrase, "There's not a dime's worth of difference between the Democrats and the Republicans." And he was very much, he was a Southern conservative that was very much on his way of changing the Democratic Party. And then when it appeared that he wasn't, that those who controlled the Democratic Party weren't going to allow him to be a part of their little party, he decided to run as an independent. And then suddenly we have a crazed lone gunman that shoots him. Now, this guy didn't kill him. I'm stalling trying to remember this guy's name. I believe he was the governor of Alabama. I better just look that up. George Wallace. That was his name. George Wallace was his name. Now, and I'm not saying anything positive about George Wallace. His racist problems were well known. But I am going to say that he was in the process of shaking up the Democratic Party, and he was in the process of shaking up the election. Let's see what year he was shot. Okay, this is from Wikipedia. It says George Corley Wallace. George Corley Wallace, Jr., August 25th, 1919 to September 13th, 1998, was an American politician and the 45th governor of Alabama, serving four terms. Then it lists the terms. After four runs for the U.S. president, three as a Democrat and one on the American Independent Party ticket, he earned the title of the most influential loser of the 20th century, according to biographer Dan T. Carter. Biographers in the plural, Dan T. Carter and Stephen Lesher. a 1972, so it was the 72 election. The 72 election was when he ran as the American Independent, and that's when he was, there was the assassination attempt. The guy shot him. If I recall, it severed his spine, and he was wheelchair-bound for the rest of his life, and eventually died some, what was it? Oh, my. He lived a long time after being after the assassination attempt. But it ended his political career, pretty much. I think he may have been elected as governor a couple more times, but it stopped his national political career. And I believe, I'm not reading now, but if I recall, his wife took over for governor in his place or something to that effect. Either way, that's how they were dealt with. The lone crazed gunman was the popular alternative in those days, and we are told that these are completely unconnected. So I have stated this, that I really don't want Ron Paul to become the Republican nominee or even to show really good in the contest, because they'll just kill him. And if they don't kill him, if by some strange chance the massive amount of money people with the massive amount of money that control the Republican Party, if by some chance that he gets control, that he is in that position of getting the nomination and they haven't assassinated him, what are the odds that the main body of the GOP is going to support him? If you really think about what these people believe, are they really going to come out in the kind of numbers that it takes? And the Ron Paul supporters are right now, they're saying, yes, they will. They will. They'll come out. Once the Ron Paul message gets out, I understand your enthusiasm. I really do. I understand your enthusiasm. But when you realize the quantity of people who work for the U.S. government or work for military contractors for the U.S. government, or work for contractors for the highway department, or work for contractors for the variety of the alphabet soup out there that is affected by the government and the pay, you know, that think of one company, think of General Electric. If you don't know how massive this one company is, it's not that hard to find out. They're huge. And if Ron Paul were to be elected, General Electric would take a major hit, because here's a man controlling all the purse strings of the nation. He's not going to continue to funnel massive amounts of money into these pet companies like GE and Monsanto and these other companies like this. He's not going to do that. So what's going to happen? Those people will understand that. Unions around the country will beg all their union members and threaten their union members and cry to their union members. They'll come at Ron Paul with every accusation possible. And then if the economy so much as burps, again, I've been away from podcasting for a while, so if the economy does anything, the slightest hiccup at all, if he were to become president, everything will be blamed on Ron Paul. Everything will be his fault. The media is not going to back him up. The media is not going to treat him with kid gloves like they did Barack Obama or like they did George Bush during the first 7 years of his presidency. They're not going to treat Ron Paul like that. Everything that goes wrong is going to be Ron Paul's fault. The media halfway blamed Katrina on George Bush. What do you think they're going to do when Ron Paul's there? But even if all the fantasy comes true, even if Ron Paul can make his way into the presidency and he shuts down the Federal Reserve and he does all these wonderful things and he stops the wars and he brings home the troops and he does all these things that he says that he's going to do and the things that his supporters want him to do, what have you done? What have you done? You've given the state a whole new lease on life. You have just now handed, I said this once before. I said, if there was a guy and he's standing in front of you and he's holding a pistol on you and he's robbing you, he's in the process of robbing you, and he's warned you several times that he's going to shoot you, and then you see him, his finger flicks and the trigger pulls and the gun jams, and he's not able to kill you. Should your reaction to this situation be, oh, hey, I know how to clear that particular firearm. Let me fix that for you. And he hands you the gun, and you clear it, and you get it all back to perfect working order, and hand him back the gun and say, okay, there you go. Well, that's what's going to happen, or that's what would happen if in an imaginary world where Ron Paul could actually do this. If you put Ron Paul in there, and Ron Paul comes in, and Ron Paul fixes the economy, and fixes the government, and puts us on a stable money system, and does all these wonderful things that all of you want him to do, what you've just done is you have cleared that jammed round, and you've handed the state back a fully loaded pistol, because Ron Paul will not be president forever. Think about it. Think about this. You're helping. If in this fantasy world where Ron Paul could go in and fix everything, what is it he's fixing? He's fixing this beast that's going to use everything in its powers to hurt people. That's what the state is. And you want Ron Paul to fix it so it works more efficient, so it works better, so it lasts longer? Where is that mentality coming from? Okay, I got to get off of this. Otherwise, I will do nothing but talk about Ron Paul yet again. And I have to give this disclaimer. You know, Ron Paul and I would disagree on very few things. If we could sit down and he and I could sit at a table and we could just take 2 or 3 or 6 hours and just roll over everything that we believe, Ron Paul and I probably disagree on a very, very tiny amount of stuff. But the one thing that we disagree with, that we disagree on, that stands in such stark, it is absolute opposites, is the idea that you can fix the state by using the power of the state. That government, still controlled by the state, can be fixed using the government. This is like, a person. Well, we just dealt with a death in the family of cancer, so this is an appropriate comparison. It's like if you're a doctor, you know, like named Paul, you're a doctor and you have a patient that has terminal cancer, and so you say, oh, I know what they need. Let's inject them with terminal cancer. Let's give them more cancer. That's what this is like. You can't fix the evils of the state by helping the state. That's crazy. 2 wrongs don't make a right. 8,000 wrongs don't make a right. 10 billion wrongs don't make a right. Joining the wrongs club and becoming a wrong and helping them do their job more efficiently doesn't make it right. The state is still evil. The state, by its very existence, is the use of aggression to secure a geographical area. That's bad. That's not good. The use of aggression is not legitimate. It is against moral principles. And that's what the state is based on. And so why do you want that to run more efficiently? I don't know if I'm going to be able to break away from this and talk about anything else at all today. You know? Okay, maybe if I just pull up the internet here and I go to... Here's a story from the other day. 40,000 new laws in the U.S. that start on January 1st. Isn't that nice? This is what we're walking into. A new year with 40,000 new laws in the U.S. And they're 40,000. You know, this is the mainstream media reporting this. So that includes city, state, local, counties, all the way up to the federal level. Including everything from rules in Social Security to rules about light bulbs to rules about, everything you can imagine. Mainstream media reporting on this uses the phrase, even including driving golf carts in Georgia. Well, you know. So what's the purpose of all this? What's the purpose of just continuing to have more and more laws? Well, that's because it's the only thing the state can do. The state can't shrink. The state can only bring more and more and more force, more aggression. And how does it do that? By passing more and more and more laws. I wasn't going to go into this right away. I'm getting out of order in the things I was going to talk to you about. But there was an interesting article over at Lou Rockwell, lourockwell.com the other day. And it's in, and I'll put a link to this. It's called The Importance of a Second Slave Card. And this is by Jeff Berwick. And essentially, what he's saying here is that you need to get your passport and you need to get all of your papers in line so that you can flee the country if you need to, because with the new goofy laws that they're passing in the U.S., people need the ability to get out of the U.S. And I wouldn't necessarily disagree with him for people that, for people who have that as an option. For me personally, that's not an option. But I can understand why people who have that as an option should get their paperwork together and be at all times prepared to get out of the country, because things in the U.S. are really getting weird. But the point he makes in here that I find really fascinating, and, he says, in reference to criminal records, he says, governments have started to realize that one of the best ways to ensure that their tax slaves can't travel is to give them a criminal record. Okay, now think about this for a minute. Right now, the whole Republican Party almost is clamoring to secure the borders. Even the magical Ron Paul wants to secure the borders. Just take that and mentally set that on a shelf for a second. The fascination with securing the borders. Just set that on the shelf just for a moment. Did you know that by about the age of 25, a third of Americans have a criminal record? Almost all of those are for some minor nonviolent thing like marijuana or something like that. By the age of 25, almost a third of Americans have a criminal record. Now, you have a criminal record. Try going down and getting a travel visa and a passport. Go ahead. Now, we just witnessed here in the U.S. the almost resistant free, is that a way to put that? The almost unanimous passing of legislation and signing by the president that gives the military, the U.S. military, the authorization to just pick up anybody they want, charge them with nothing, disappear them in the middle of the night if they so wish, haul them to a concentration camp of their choosing, of the military's choosing, keep them as long as they want without charging them for with a crime, and do so without giving them any legal representation at all. This is now legal in the U.S., and the president signed it. And the president almost didn't sign it. And you know why he almost didn't sign it? Because he's already declared that he had that power even without this. And his attorneys were concerned that by signing this, he was indicating that he didn't already have that power. And yet he went ahead and signed it anyway. So now we already know that the president, without a trial, can have anyone assassinated that he wants. For example, we had an American citizen who was traveling, who was overseas, and he had said some words that the president didn't like. Words. He said words, and the president didn't like those words. So the president had a drone attack and killed him, along with everybody who was near him at the time. Now, that happened. That already has happened. Then it turns out the dead guy had a 15, 16-year-old son who had never even said these bad words, who had never indicated in any way that he was going to be bad or that he was going to do anything bad or that he was going to influence anybody to do anything bad. And the president decided it was a good idea to kill him and his teenage friends at the same time. Why? Because his dad was bad and we killed his... not me. I didn't do it. Obama ordered it. And some military people helped him, and some private contractors helped him, and they murdered the man. And then they decided that his son was a risk because his son might get mad about that and his son might turn bad. Now think about that. The president murdered a man because he said words. No trial, no arrest. Murdered him and everybody that was around him at the time. So you were murdered if you were just standing next to the guy. You're dead. Just like that. Then the president murdered his son, not for anything he did, not because he said bad words, not because he influenced anybody to do anything, but because he might turn bad someday. You just think about that in your head for a second. That is already done. And now we pass a rule that it says it doesn't, they don't even need the president to do these things. They can snatch anybody they want. All they have to do is say, oh, nope, terrorist, terrorist. They can snatch anybody they want anywhere in the world and hold them as long as they want without trial, without accusation, other than saying, yeah, they're terrorist. That's all they have to do. Now, that's the situation we're in. And if anybody wants to flee this country and get to a safer country, well, you know, they're trying to secure the borders right now. They're trying to get the borders so that nobody can cross the borders into the U.S. But when you get the border, assuming this magical process could even take place, but if you got the border between the U.S. and Mexico secured, of course, it's going to be obvious, too, and they're already starting this process. The border into Canada is becoming more and more of a problem to get across. And there's some prominent YouTube videos of perfectly innocent Canadians trying to come into the U.S. to go for a day of shopping at a mall. And the torture that they go through for that process is just amazing. Well, so we secure the borders like all you Republicans want to do. And a third of the young people coming up are now given criminal records, mostly over stupid things that are not, where no one has been harmed. No real law. We're talking about actual law, you know, like the law where if you harm someone or their property, that's bad. That law, we're not talking about that. We're talking about you were caught in possession of something that the government has said is bad. We're just seeing a constant creation of more and more and more laws. And already we're at a third of young people with a criminal violation of some kind on their record. And now we're securing the borders. And when things get so bad, oh, and they can just pick you up anytime they want for anything they want. They can kill you anytime they want for anything they want. Now, how are you going to leave? When things get so bad, how are you going to leave? And now here's the other thing, folks. If you're of the mindset to say, well, when they come to a certain point, once they cross a certain line, we're going to stand up to them. Don't do that. Don't even think that way. Standing up to the United States government means instant death. Not only is it illogical to fight the most powerful crime gang that the world has ever known, not only is it illogical because they are, when it comes, you know, I talk about the incompetency of the state a lot, but there's something that the state can do with blinding efficiency, kill you. They can do this. This is one thing they know how to do, and they will do it. If you resist the state using the methods of the state, they will kill you. They want you to react that way. They want every libertarian in the United States to be exactly the stereotypical militant nut job. That's what they want, because they know exactly how to handle you. When you are that stereotypical militant nut job, they know what to do with you. Ask David Koresh. Give them an excuse. Even a little excuse. They don't need a big excuse. Give them a little excuse. And you're dead. That's it. Especially now. And it's going to get worse. So what do we do about it? You don't fight an enemy. On the battlefield, the enemy chooses with the weapons that the enemy chooses. You don't do that. You don't fight the enemy when the enemy wants to have a fight. You don't fight the enemy where the enemy wants to fight you. And you don't fight the enemy how the enemy wants you to fight. Our only way to fight the state is not getting involved in voting, and is not picking up your guns and fighting the state. These things are the methods of the state. The only way to defeat the state is through setting up private communication networks, through setting up private markets of every kind. This is the way to fight the state. This is the way to defeat the state. Not through violence, not through elections, not through force of any kind, because elections, don't fool yourself, folks, elections are aggression. They are. When the will of a majority is inflicting itself upon a minority, that's aggression, and that's what an election is. And when you vote, you take part in that. You become a part of that. So using aggression on any level, from a simple voting to taking up arms, you cannot defeat the state, because these are the methods of the state. If you're going to fight Jackie Chan, are you going to go up to Jackie Chan and challenge him to a physical, like a fight, like, you know? Are you going to do that with the legendary Chuck Norris, the internet guru of the world? Are you going to try to take on Chuck Norris on a nose-to-nose fight? Well, it's crazy. Wait till they're asleep and whack them in the head with something. You see, and I'm not advocating violence against Chuck Norris or Jackie Chan, but I'm saying that you do not fight your enemy using the method that the enemy has refined to almost an infinite point. You look and you see what's my enemy weak at? Ah, the enemy is weak at controlling black markets. The enemy is weak at controlling private communications. That's why the state puts so much effort into controlling markets and fighting black markets, because it can't control them. And that's why the state puts so much effort into controlling communications, because these are its weakest points. Communication, private education, individual-to-individual education, private trade, private commerce, in everything. Black markets in everything. I'm talking about everything from big things, real estate. Figure it out. Somebody figure out how we can have black markets in real estate, and let's start doing it. That'll drive the state nuts. Let's figure out how we can have black market banking. Black market banking is simple to do. It's easy to do. Black market banking already takes place. There's a lot of black market banking. It's just not done by libertarians and people in the liberty movement, by anarchists. But we need to do this. Take a lesson from, you know, I mentioned the mafia a minute ago. The mafia has all kinds of networks of underground banking. They do it all the time. Biker gangs have networks of underground banking. Crime gangs of different kinds have underground banking. They have to. It's part of how they function, and we can do this too. We can create underground libertarian banking processes where people can obtain loans through other libertarian methods, through other libertarians. Where financing can be created to open businesses. This stuff can take place if we just do it. We get the message out to the right people, and people begin to understand how easy this would be. And we can begin to eliminate the power of the Federal Reserve, not by electing a guy who's going to go up and use the aggression of government to try to fix the aggression of government, but by creating our own banking system that's free. It's so simple, folks. It really is. All we have to do is do it. All we have to do is pretend there is no state, and there is no state. It ceases to exist. And as we do that among ourselves, the state, we literally pull the power out of the state's arms. I was not going to go down this direction, but I'm already there. So, We have already, at this point, a third of young people with criminal records. We're securing the borders as fast as we can. I say we. I'm not doing it. The government's doing this. We've got a lot of background noise coming. Ah, evidently that's the body shop working on something over there. Okay, we'll just plow through the noise. Hopefully it won't be too bad on the recording. So, a third of young people with convictions on their record, securing the borders, making it legal to arrest anybody they want, disappear them from society. And yet, we're not paranoid. We're not thinking of the, you know, this is not InfoWars here. We're not thinking that they're scooping us all up and rounding us all up. No, they want us working. They want us sitting in our cubicles. They want us numbed in our brains from the continuous 8-hour cycle and the packed freeways full of cars. They want us like that. They want us working. They want us enslaved. They want us paying taxes. They don't want us privately exchanging without them involved. That's the one thing they don't want. All right, let's see what was next on my list here. Oh, war. Yeah. How close are we to being in an active shooting war with Iran? Well, as of the recording of this, and it could change any moment, we're pretty close. We are pretty close. I made some predictions last year on a forum, and I really thought we would have done an official invasion of Mexico by this point. But apparently I was wrong, because now it looks like we're actually going to be fighting Iran before we invade Mexico. Oh, we will invade Mexico. I keep saying we're not going to do this. It's really a bad habit. It's not we. I'm not invading anybody. I have nothing against Iran or Mexico. But the U.S. government, it looks in every way like the U.S. government has succeeded in provoking the war with Iran that the U.S. government has been seeking for years and years. And if you're not sure, or if you think, well, Iran is the bad guys, look, I'm not saying they're good. I'm not saying any state is good. But the government of the U.S. has consistently spent years and years and years attempting to provoke Iran into giving the U.S. an excuse to attack it. If you take your historical blinders off and you realize how much effort the United States government in Washington, D.C. put, how much effort they put into getting Japan to attack the U.S. Prior to World War II. When you start to look into this and you start to see how actively the U.S. Government worked to get the Japanese government to attack the U.S., even so much as basically baiting them in the way that we stored our airplanes on the runways in Pearl Harbor, and how the boats were situated in the harbor there at Pearl, how we took all of our old out of date ships out of the safe harbors on the west coast of the U.S. and moved them in what was clearly an aggressive move to move them out to Pearl to begin with. How we went out and aggressively put bases on Midway and, I can't remember the other base that we set up as an open act of aggression against Japan. We did these things. I wasn't there. Bad habit. The U.S. government in Washington did these things as clear acts of aggression against the Japanese government long before December 7th, 1941. They knew, the government in Washington knew well in advance that the attack was going to take place. They knew well in advance that the fleet was on its way. They knew almost to the minute when the Japanese were going to attack. And not only did they do nothing to preserve the lives of the however many thousands it was that were killed at Pearl Harbor. Not only did the U.S. government do nothing to prevent it, they actually set those people up to be murdered that way. Now, that's not conspiracy theory. There's a lot of information that's now coming out that supports exactly what I just said. And this is exactly what we've been doing with Iran. Not we. The U.S. government has been doing this stuff with Iran. And so, are we going to go into a war with Iran? Well, you know, we already have Iran surrounded with bases. We literally have invaded its neighbors to the east and its neighbors to the west and are occupying those two countries. We, again, I haven't done these things. The U.S. government. That's a horrible habit to get into. So, will the U.S. government eventually provoke Iran to blink and make a move of some kind? It's an old game. You know, I've talked about this before. When I was a kid, I was told very clearly by my father that if I ever started a fight, that I would get a spanking. I would get in trouble with him. Although, I don't think he ever really made it clear that he was going to spank me. And if I recall, I think he only actually spanked me twice. But the inference was there. Either way, I would get in trouble. If I ever started a fight, I would get in trouble. So for this reason, I would never throw the first punch in a fight. And by the time I got to about the fifth grade, I learned that that was a bad policy. Because when you're first, second, third grade, and another kid pops you in the face, it stings a little bit. But when you get up to about the fifth grade, kids get bigger. And so I think it was the summer between the fifth and sixth grade, or the summer between the fourth and the fifth grade. I can't remember exactly which, but it was right around the fifth grade age. And I had a little conflict with another kid, and he made some kind of gestures to me, and I stepped up close to him, and he popped me in the nose, and my nose just splattered blood everywhere. And he jumped back, and I aggressed forward towards him, and he popped me in the nose again. And with two straight punches in the nose, I was bleeding so bad that I could barely see. I could barely breathe. And he, well, then I went for my knife, of course. Who wouldn't? I mean, and he ran, and I chased him. But he got away from me because he was a year older than me. He was bigger, and that's a big deal when you're in the fifth grade and you're trying to catch a sixth grader or whereabouts in that age group. And so he got away from me, but I learned a lesson in that, and that is to never let somebody hit you first. I learned that lesson. So then what do you do? How do you follow the rule of never throwing the first punch while also following the rule of never letting somebody hit you first? And the solution I came to was I learned how to just move my left arm in a way that made the other person think that I was getting ready to hit them. And then when they moved to block my left arm, I would make it appear as though they were attempting to swing at me by then blocking them, again using my left arm. So I made it look like they're trying to swing at me, and I blocked them with my left arm, and then I could pop them with my right. And I learned that pretty early on, by fifth, sixth grade. And so I utilized that method back in those days, I fought a lot, all the way up until, well into adulthood. When I was, 19, I was utilizing my skills quite aggressively and making a living doing it. And I learned that this is exactly what you do. If there are witnesses and you don't want to get in trouble for starting a fight, you act in a way that provokes the other person to move aggressively. And then you appear to move in a defensive fashion. But you're not really. You're really starting the fight. And I had that, by the time I was 19, I had that to an art form. I could literally start a fight in front of a cop if I wanted to. And the cop would think I was just defending myself. Because I had just refined this process. And that's exactly what the U.S. government has been doing, has done in the past. Spanish-American War is a good example. World War I, they didn't even go to that much effort. They just lied to the American people and we entered it. World War II, we did that. Gulf of Tonkin, the United States government did that. In the Gulf of Tonkin, they lied about it, but they lied about a about an attack, and they used that excuse. Anyway, back to the topic at hand. So we've got 40,000 new laws to enter the new year with. We're on the verge of a war with yet another country, about to go to war with them. On that topic, on the topic of Iran, Walter Block wrote a thing that appeared over at lewrockwell.com, and I'll try to put the link to that on this page, where Walter Block goes through the basic situation, and he asks who is the aggressor here, and he gives some really good thoughts about a Rothbardian approach to atomic weaponry, and essentially says, Walter Block does a really good job in this article of making the argument that indeed the U.S. is the aggressor. Not that anybody is happy that Iran may or may not obtain weapons of mass destruction, but that clearly the U.S. government has been and continues to be the aggressor. And that, but here's the problem, even with Walter's article. From everything that I'm seeing, Iran is not attempting to create weapons of mass destruction. They're attempting to create electricity. They're attempting to get their own ability to have a nuclear reactor so that they can make electricity, because they don't have any refineries. They have oil, but they don't have refineries, so they can't convert it into fuel to run in electrical generation. And they don't have any nuclear power plants. And everything that I'm seeing indicates that that's what's going on, and the West is using that as an excuse, saying that they're attempting to make weapons of mass destruction. But even if they are, and what Walter Block points out here is that the U.S. has thousands of those, and the U.S. is the only government that has a track record of using them. So the U.S. government is not really in a position to point their finger at Iran, now are they? Okay, so I need to wrap this up because I've just rambled on too long. I had a really interesting YouTube video that I was going to play the audio for it. And what I'll do is I'll just go ahead and hook a link up on this page to this video. It's from Russia Today, and it talks about how the Arab Spring and all that, the whole uprising across North Africa and throughout the Middle East was purely engineered by the powers of in Washington. I'll put the link at badquaker.com to that article. And let's see, what else we have here? The criminal records. I didn't get to talk about everything that I had planned today, but this is, again, I'm really kind of, my brain's going in circles from all the family situation that we have going on. And so if I seem a little disjointed, it's because I am. So, I hope I made a point in there. I hope there's not just a lot of rambling. I'll go back. I'll have to edit this anyway, so I'll go back and listen to it. And there's a good possibility I'll just throw it away, because I don't know. I don't know what I just said. So we'll have to figure that out. And maybe this one will just go the way of the other attempts, and there will be no podcast for Thursday. Either way, how about this? How about if I wrap this up and I say, go over to badquaker.com and look things over and get into the archive and hear some of the old stuff before it all disappears. And for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com and email me. Oh, you know what? That's the other thing. I got a bunch of emails that I haven't got to respond to. And I was even going to read the comments of a commenter on badquaker.com named Chris that said, in reference to one of the earlier podcasts where we talked about what we should call ourselves, and I was mentioning abolitionist and anarcho-abolitionist, and he brought up self-owners and self-ownership, and that's really good stuff. And I'm maybe next time I can read that, because he really hit the nail right on the head on, with that, with his comments. Or you can read that. Go over to badquaker.com, and over on the right-hand side, scroll down, and you'll see a listing of where it says recent comments. And you'll see Chris listed there, and just click on that, and you can go right over and read his comments. Folks, again, for the second or maybe third time signing off, thank you very much for listening to badquaker.com. Goodbye.